September 26, 2010, in Radadesh, the reading from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila, Chapter 19, the Lord instructs Srila Rupa Goswami. Here is the section where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is speaking about the Bhakti Lata Bija. That analogy was started in text 151, today we're reading 153. Upajiya bale lata brahmanda bediyaya viraja brahma loka bedi paravyoma paya.
Upajiya, being cultivated, bade, increases, lata, the creeper of devotional service, brahmanda, the whole universe, bedi, penetrating, yaya, goes, viraja, the river between the spiritual world and the material world, brahma loka, the brahman effulgence, bedi, penetrating, paravyoma, spiritual sky, haya, attains. Translation. As one waters the bhakti lata bija, the seed sprouts. What does bhakti lata bija mean literally? Seed of the creeper of devotion. So bhakti is love and devotion, lata is a vine, a creeper, and bija is a seed. As one waters the bhakti lata bija, the seed sprouts. And the creeper gradually increases to the point where it penetrates the walls of this universe and goes beyond the Viraja river between the spiritual world and the material world. It attains Brahmaloka, the Brahman effulgence, and penetrating through that stratum, it reaches the spiritual sky and the spiritual planet Golok Vrindavan. I'd like to go back just and read the last two translations. According to their karma, all living entities are wandering throughout the entire universe. Some of them are being elevated to the upper planetary systems, and some are going down into the lower planetary systems. Out of many millions of wandering living entities, one who is very fortunate gets an opportunity to associate with a bona fide spiritual master by the grace of Krishna. By the mercy of both Krishna and the spiritual master, such a person receives the seed of the creeper of devotional service, and bhakti lata bija. When a person receives the seed of devotional service, he should take care of it by becoming a gardener and sowing the seed in his heart. If he waters the seed gradually by the process of shravana and kirtan, hearing and chanting, the seed will begin to sprout, in today's translation. As one waters the bhakti lata bija, the seed sprouts, and the creeper gradually increases to the point where it penetrates the walls of this universe and goes beyond the Viraja River between the spiritual world and the material world. It attains Brahmaloka, the Brahman effulgence, and penetrating through that stratum, it reaches the spiritual sky and the spiritual planet, Loka Vrindavan. Before I read the purport, I'd like to just see if we can remember so far the steps in this analogy. So, what happens first?
Shraddha.
Shraddha, well, yes, but in the analogy.
Mercy and Guru and Krishna.
Mercy and Guru and Krishna. Who gets the mercy and Guru and Krishna? A fortunate soul. So first you have to be, first thing is you're before you're fortunate, you're doing what? Well, maybe. You're traveling through the universe. You do some pious activity, some simple. So first you're traveling. First you're a traveler. Okay? The next thing, that's the next step. You become fortunate. The men also can do that. And then when you're fortunate, you get what? What's the next thing that happens?
You get mercy.
You get mercy. And the mercy in this analogy takes the form of a? From the spiritual master and Krishna, and you get a what?
Seed.
Seed. You get a seed. Who here has ever planted a seed? Anybody ever planted a seed? About half. I'm sure when this analogy was given, pretty much everybody had planted seeds. Okay, so you take the seed, and then what do? What's the next step? You have to what? Before you water it, you have to plant it. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, when a person receives the seed of devotional service, he should take care of it by becoming a gardener and sowing the seed in his heart. So Guru and Krishna give the seed. You're wandering, you become fortunate, Guru Krishna gives you a seed, and then you plant it. Next you? You water it. Okay, now in today's verse, what happens when you water a seed? You all remember from science class way back when you watered seeds in school? What do? They sprout. Okay? And then, after it sprouts, it starts
growing.
Okay, now what kind of a plant is this again? It's a bhakti plant, but what kind of plant? A lata. A lata is a creeper, vine. Now what does a vine need? A tree or something. You know, something that needs to grow onto something. Needs to grow onto something. So when you plant a seed that's of a vine, what is it? Who here has ever planted a vine of something? Who's ever planted a vine of something? Okay. So when you plant something that's a bush, or like a little pepper plant or a marigold, it just expands sort of round it. But when you plant a vine, a watermelon, cucumber, pumpkin, and what does it do?
It spreads all over the place.
It spreads all over the place, right? It's searching for shelter, searching for shelter. So this bhakti lata, where does it start growing, looking for shelter? Where does Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says it's growing?
In the heart.
In the heart, but it grows out of the heart here. Where does it go to grow to? It goes all the way to the Viraja River, which means first to get to the Viraja River, it has to? Has to cross the entire material universe. And then it has to go through the shell. Bathing, it's penetrating. It has to go through the shell. And then it comes to the Viraja River. And then it has to do what?
Cross
the river. And then? That's in the Brahma Jyoti. Yes, and then?
Spiritual
sky, and then Goloka Vrindavan. That's where we're ending today. So we arrive at some journey, huh? It's like you may take a journey to Vrindavan on this planet. So you've got to first have a desire, and you have to earn the money for your ticket, and you buy your ticket, and then you've got to drive to the airport. You've got to penetrate through the barrier of the security. You've got to get your visa. Some of you just went and got a visa. And then, you know, you have to go through the whole material universe, practically speaking. Go through the higher and middle and lower planetary systems. And then finally you come to the spiritual sky. You come to Mathura Mandala, you come to Goloka Vrindavan. Purport. A creeper generally takes shelter of a big tree, but the bhakti lata being the creeper of spiritual energy. So this is the creeper of what? Spiritual energy. Srila Prabhupada in a number of places, of course we all know her expansions of Krishna, Mama Vamsa Jiva Loke, Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. Okay, so Prabhupada generally talks about how we are expansions of Krishna, but there's many places where he says that we're expansions of Radharani. That we are all spiritual energy. And Prabhupada is saying here that this bhakti kripa is the creeper of spiritual energy. Being the creeper of spiritual energy cannot take shelter of any material planet. For there is no tree on any material planet that the bhakti lata kripa can utilize for shelter. So this wherever spiritual energy cannot take shelter of anything material. In other words, now Prabhupada is defining this in a very interesting way. In other words, devotional service cannot be utilized for any material purpose. Devotional service is meant only for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sometimes men with a poor fund of knowledge, this is one of Prabhupada's favorite expressions, poor fund of knowledge. So, it's a very polite way of saying you're an somebody, you don't know anything. You say, well, you kind of have a poor fund of knowledge there. Sometimes men with a poor fund of knowledge maintain they don't have much in their knowledge bank account. Maintain that bhakti can be applied to material things also. So if you've ever seen the Indian movies of Mahabharata, which, by the way, are very good movies, but they put the director and the producer of the movies like to put words in the mouths of the characters that didn't come out of the Mahabharata, and even concepts that weren't in the Mahabharata, and he constantly has Bhishma talking about desh prem. Desh is place, nation. Praying for your country. Some people think like this. Men with a poor fund of knowledge maintain that bhakti can be applied to material things also. In other words, they say that devotional service can be rendered to one's country or to the demigods, but this is not a fact. Devotional service is especially meant for the Supreme Personality of Godhead and is beyond the material range. There is a river or causal ocean between the spiritual and material natures, and this river is freed from the influence of the three modes of material nature. Therefore, it is called Viraja. The word vi means vigata, completely eradicated, and rajaha means the influence of the material world. So, of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he talks about separation from Krishna, he says viraga, he uses this word vi to mean separated. On this platform, a living entity is completely free from material entanglement. So this is a platform of liberation, but not yet devotional service. Viraja, one's free from rajaha. For the jnanis who want to merge into the Brahman effulgence, there is Brahmaloka. Bhakti Lata, however, has no shelter in the material world, nor has it any shelter in Brahmaloka, although Brahmaloka is beyond the material world. The bhakti lata increases until it reaches the spiritual sky where Goloka Vrindavana is situated. Upajiya bade lata brahmanda bedi yaya viraja brahmaloka bedi paravyoma paya. As one waters the bhakti lata bija, the seed sprouts, and the creeper gradually increases to the point where it penetrates the walls of this universe and goes beyond the viraja river between the spiritual world and the material world. It attains Brahmaloka, the Brahman effulgence, and penetrating through that stratum, it reaches the spiritual sky and the spiritual planet, Goloka Vrindavana. I'm just thinking of the book cover for Easy Journey to Other Planets, where you see the shaved up Brahmacharya with his chopper beads going through the material universe. Just remember that? Have you all seen that cover? We should have it. Primitive visual. So, first thing we see from this, because this is a college town. You all know what a college town is. When I first went to college, I went to Bennington University, which is in Bennington, Vermont. And it's a college town. The whole town is dominated by college. So here, Radhanesh, we also very much have college. So because this is a college town, and we're interested in education, thank you, managers of Radhanesh, for having the center that's interested in education. So, if we want to know how to educate, and we're talking about possibly having a degree in education, we're considering it. So, we want to know what is transcendental education. And here we can see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Supreme Teacher, is using an educational technique. What educational technique is he using? A metaphor. And we see throughout the Shastra, and throughout the examples of the acharyas, they teach through metaphors. And if we also want to teach not only others, but also even ourselves, metaphors are a very useful tool. We find Narada Muni, he seems to be one of the top experts at the art of metaphor. But Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, and of course Srila Prabhupada, also frequently employ forms of metaphor. Similes, metaphors, analogies, where you compare something to something else. So metaphors and analogies, all forms of analogies, they're very useful in many ways. First of all, they take something that you know. Of course, that depends on the culture.
So in an agrarian culture, everyone knew about seeds. Today we're not sure. What's a seed? What do I do with it? What happens when I put water on it? Right? But in that culture, everyone understood you take a seed, you have to put it in the ground, you water it, it grows, and they knew what a vine was. Say, oh, that's something I understand. Okay, well, the development of bhakti is something like that. Oh, okay. Because otherwise, if you try to explain some very esoteric topic, people become lost. So that's one value of analogy. It takes something unfamiliar and makes it easy to understand by comparing it to something familiar. But there's some other wonderful benefits of teaching through metaphors. One is that it's a lot of fun. I once did an experiment, a failed experiment, at our Soho temple. It was the appearance or disappearance day of Madhvacharya. And I decided to give a class on Madhvacharya's philosophy. About 15 minutes into the class, I switched gears because it was hopeless. It was just, people were just like, what? And so stories are fun, and we find, of course, especially in this age, Vyasadeva compiled the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. They're so much fun. Whereas just philosophy. I remember when I was reading the Bhagavatam when I was a fairly new member of the Hare Krishna movement. And Prabhupada was translating the books. He'd gotten up to fourth canto. And I thought that I would never catch up with Srila Prabhupada. I was really worried that. So I really wanted to read the books and keep up with Srila Prabhupada. Of course, I wasn't just reading. I had a whole study program. In those days, there were no computers. You know, we just had electric typewriters. So I had a little file box and little cards, you know, to take notes. And Prabhupada said that the best thing was to start at the beginning of the Bhagavatam and go all the way through, step by step. So I thought, okay, I'll do that. But the second canto, a lot of the second canto, was very difficult for me. It was all this complicated philosophy and time according to the movements of the atom. It's like, what in the world is this talking about? And I was reading it just because Prabhupada said I should read it. You know, I can't say I understood more than, you know, the ands and the thes and the us and the purports. And then finally I got to Lord Varaha. It was so exciting to come to a story. And I think I just read all night until I finished that whole story. And we find that also in preaching. In preaching and teaching, as soon as you tell a story, everybody is attentive. It's quite interesting. You know, philosophy people or whatever, maybe they've been texting on their phone or thinking about what they're going to do at 10 o'clock in the morning. But when you tell a story, people become attentive. And scientifically, they found that when you tell a story, if you're a good storyteller, that people's brains go into a light trance. And you can see this as a teacher. You'll see that people, their bodies become still and they become very fixed. So it's much easier to meditate on stories than it is to meditate on philosophy. And there's another advantage to the metaphor, and that is that it bypasses the defense mechanism of our false ego. So if I say to you, you should be honest, you shouldn't lie, it's really bad to lie, you know, if you lie, then nobody will trust you anymore. You have all these what is she telling me that for? What does she think she is? You know, and maybe she told a lie one time too. You know, you really could get into this whole false ego thing. I'm sure we've all experienced that when we try to give instruction to somebody in form of some kind of an admonition, that usually it isn't taken very well. Do we have this experience when we try to instruct somebody with a you should? And if someone tries to instruct us with a you should, do we really enjoy that? But when you tell a story, nobody thinks you're talking about them. And so if you just tell the story of the boy who called Wolf and he kept saying Wolf, and then there was the real Wolf came, and so nobody came to help him, it's just a fun story. And I'm not saying that you're a liar, and so you can take it. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's a great story. And one of the main ways we're having
a teaching class on ISKCON and society, one of the main ways that society transmits its culture is through stories. And the class I'm preparing for now, sorry, we always end up bringing our stuff into the class, but I'm preparing for now a class on organizational culture. What's the mood in a culture? And we're going to be looking at the organizational culture of ISKCON. Is it a bureaucratic culture where we're just trying to be efficient and follow the rules and everything's playing by the rules? Is it an entrepreneurial, inventive culture where we really encourage people to find novel ways of spreading Krishna consciousness? Is it a competitive culture where we're saying we're better than all the other religious systems in the world, and we're better than the materialists, or even better than the other Gaudiya Vaishnava groups, we're better than everybody? Or is it a very caring culture where we have a mood of a family, and if you get sick, people will come and bring you some herbal tea, and they'll take care of you? And what kind of, those are the four main kinds of organizational culture. So what kind of organizational culture do we have? Or it's probably going to be a combination of those. And what do we like to have? I even took a little test. Prajapati Hari Prabhu said, aren't we about finding a test on organizational culture? So I took a little test as to what I thought ISKCON is and what I thought it would like to be. I was kind of surprised at even my own feelings about it, what I thought it would like to be. But how do you develop the culture of an organization? How do you develop it, or how do you maintain it? And one of the ways is through stories. Especially what stories you glorify. So there are certain stories that go around ISKCON, particularly of certain devotees. Both positive and negative, by the way. You form an organizational culture both by who you glorify and who you vilify. Not only do you glorify, who are the heroes and who are the villains? Who do you use as an example of someone that did something good, and who do you use as an example of someone who did something bad? And who do we glorify? Do we glorify the people who play by the rules and are part of the bureaucracy? Do we glorify the people who do something innovative? I just saw on one website that Devotee Head was talking about some people who are doing innovative preaching, and all the comments were negative. People were pulling quotes from Prabhupada, you know, just stick to this, don't do any innovation. And I thought, well, there's other quotes too. When they were pulling, and I was really cutting down. Right? Or do we glorify the people who are competitive? The people who establish the supremacy of ISKCON, the supremacy of Krishna consciousness? Or do we glorify the people who create a family atmosphere and who are caring? And what kind of stories do you tell about what goes on in the movement? And this creates a sense of organizational culture. So in this particular story, our sense of love and devotion for Krishna is compared to a vine, a creeper, that needs shelter, that needs some place to latch onto. And that this creeper of love and devotion, it can only find shelter in Krishna. And just like the little baby who's hungry, it needs the mother. If you have a hungry baby, then you can try rocking it and jiggling it and singing to it, and you know, but it's going to want mommy. And only when it gets mommy is it going to be happy. And we have the same situation where we're trying to give our bhakti. We all have bhakti. Bhakti is not, in one sense, when we say we get the seed of bhakti, it's really already there. It's not really something that comes from outside. It's something that we already have, but we become aware of it. Another analogy Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gives is of the astrologer who tells the man, your father was very rich, he left you a treasure. You just have to dig for it in the right place. So we already have the treasure. We already have the seed. It's already there. But by the grace of Guru and Krishna, we become aware that we have the seed. And then we have to water it. We have to plant it. We have to water it. We have to cultivate it. Pretty soon, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu will talk about digging out the weeds, which is kind of a heavy section. But our only shelter for this natural love and devotion, we all have it. Even an animal has it. You see it manifest even in an animal that takes care of its young, or that has some love with their mate, or for their group. You know, like elephants, if one elephant is dying, all the other elephants will stay and comfort that member until they die. They won't move on. Even if there's no food or water, they'll stay with that elephant. So all living entities have
have this tendency, but we don't know where to put it. And we think, let me have bhakti for my family, let me have bhakti for my country, let me have bhakti for my society, let me have bhakti for my job, let me have bhakti for my pets, let me have bhakti for my home, let me have bhakti for my machines. And it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And we become so disappointed. And it's kind of like a vine, a substantial vine, trying to take shelter on something that just breaks. And you imagine a vine trying to climb up a rotten fence. And as the vine gets heavier, the fence just breaks. So generally, we think that the problem is with the people or things of whom I try to take shelter. But the problem is that I'm trying to take shelter of the wrong things. There's nothing wrong with, you know, our other family members. There's nothing wrong with the government or the country or the what's wrong is me, that I'm thinking that this is something that is not. That's the problem. I'm thinking that my wife, my husband, my children, my occupation, my country, my organization, my business, or even the talents I happen to have in this life, my social network, my money in the bank, my intelligence, my creativity, my artistic talents, my good qualities of being a responsible person or a truthful person or a caring person, I think that these can be my shelter. That if I just devote myself to these things, that then I'll get everything that I want. I'll get security. I'll get shelter. I'll get care. I'll get this loving reciprocation that I want. And it just doesn't work. We become disappointed again and again and again. And we, well, let me try this one. All right, well, let me try taking shelter of my musical talents. Oh, that didn't work. Let me try taking shelter of my child. Oh, that didn't work. Let me try taking shelter of my house. No, maybe this house. This car. No, maybe this car. This boyfriend. No, maybe that boyfriend. And we keep trying. Okay? Just going within the material sphere. And then if we become fortunate, Prabhupada says fortunate means a gyata sukriti. You do some unknowing devotional service. That's how you become fortunate. So by fortune, then Krishna and Guru, they reveal, listen, this seed is meant for Krishna. You have a seed of love and devotion in your heart. Who are you giving it to? Develop it in the right way. Right? Pour the real water on it. Pour the water on it of hearing and chanting about Krishna. Not hearing and chanting about movie stars or politicians, or, but hearing and chanting about Krishna. And then we'll find everything that we want. Then we'll find everything that we want. And it's the only way we're going to find everything that we want. There is no other way to find everything that we want except taking shelter of Krishna. That's all. There's no place, there's no circumstance, there's no ability, there's no person, there's no organization, there's nothing that's going to give us what we want other than Krishna. It's nothing, it just won't work. It's like you have a puzzle, you know, there's one place where each piece is going to fit. And that's where we fit. Of course, once you take shelter of Krishna, this is the mystery, then all of a sudden you have love for everybody. If you try to have love for everybody separate from Krishna, it just doesn't work. It collapses. But as soon as you give that love and devotion for Krishna, then you're happy always. Then even the material world, Prabhupada says, becomes a happy place. And in Krishna book, Prabhupada says that the materialists see this world as very aggressive, but the devotees, everything is happily situated. When I posted that on Facebook, one devotee said, oh, I thought it was the opposite. He thought the materialists think it's a happy place, and the devotees see it as aggressive. Now, one who's a real devotee, one who's taking shelter of Krishna, they're happy even here. Why? Because they're not here. Material life means thinking, okay, who's going to be my shelter now? I got to compete with other people for that shelter. And to try to get shelter from that. It's a very combative world. As soon as you have that mentality that I'm separate from Krishna, as soon as you think I'm separate from Krishna, then immediately it becomes this struggle to try to get as many of the resources as I can from the world for myself to keep them. And as soon as you realize, hey, I'm not separate from Krishna, and Om Purnamada Purnamida Purnamida Visishite Purnasya Purnamada Purnamida Visishite, Krishna is complete. As soon as I realize I'm connected with Krishna, then perfect. Then I have everything I need without any other endeavor. And then I can be happy everywhere because I have everything I need. I can be happy with everyone. I can love everyone. I can be kind to everyone if I start with Krishna consciousness. So our question should be, because we see here also in this analogy, there's something that Guru and Krishna do and there's something that I do. Somehow I become fortunate by the faith of the devotees who distribute prasada and who go out on Harinam, who distribute books. Somehow I get some fortune. Then, as soon as I'm fortunate, then by the ways of Guru and Krishna, I become aware I have a seed of bhakti in my heart, but I've got to plant it, I've got to water it, and as we'll see in the forthcoming verses, I've got to weed it. So for whatever we want in life, however it may appear, things appear in the guise of material desires, but really what we want is shelter. Shelter means I feel secure, I feel love, I can give love, I have meaning and significance in my life. When we think about everything we want, we're going to get that by planting and watering the seed. So how am I doing that? Our whole process of bhakti yoga, plant the seed, water it, weed it. Plant it, water it, be very simple. Plant it, okay? Then water and weed it. Just do that, you're fine. Because if you properly water it, properly weed it, it will naturally grow, just like an ordinary plant naturally grows toward the sun. Naturally. Plants grow toward the sun. So if we give the plant the real water, if you don't give your plant kerosene, if you give your plant real water and weed it, it'll grow to Krishna. So we should be asking ourselves that at every moment as we're doing the external activities with our body, the bhakti, are these activities watering the seed and pulling out the leaf? So thank you very much. Yes, I know I can have questions because the timekeeper asked a question. Yes, how may I
speak? So you mentioned emphasizing the taking shelter in this quote, that it is not, nothing is wrong with different objects and subjects in which we are trying to take shelter, but rather with these very ideas that we are doing that.
Yes.
And then you gave several examples, and you mentioned also spouse. And this connection, I wonder, because in different places it's mentioned that it is advised to take shelter in husband. So I wonder how does it fit in this, and is, apart from the fact that wife is encouraged to do this, his husband actually, how does he actually take this role?
Thank you. It's a very wonderful question. So, of course, the majority of the Bhagavatam, which was generally spoken to men, is talking about being careful of women. And every once in a while you have a thing in the Bhagavatam that talks about being careful of men. So when Lord Kapilade speaks to his mother, Devahuti, he says, if you think your husband is a shelter, then your husband's like a hunter who's calling a deer to their death. If you think my husband is the source of my finances, my children, my home, and then your attachment for your husband will kill you. So what I've seen is that if somebody thinks, if you think my husband, my temple president, my department head, even my guru, is going to fulfill all of my emotional needs and give me unlimited, eternal shelter and security, you're going to be a very angry person. A very frustrated person. And you're going to end up hating that authority a lot. Because it's not real. You know, you may be the best husband on the planet, but you're not God. You can't be God. In fact, whenever, if ever people try to make us God, we're very uncomfortable. You know, every once in a while you deal with some super emotionally needy person who thinks you're God. God. And if anybody were to come to us and say, you're everything to me. You're my mother. You're my father. You're my husband. You're my child. You're my group. You're my teacher. You're my best friend. You're my brother. You're my sister. You're everything to me. God. You know, if our mother tries to love us the way Mother Yasoda loves Krishna, we would run away. You haven't eaten for an hour, Krishna. You must be hungry. Don't go in the forest. Don't please me. I mean, she's such a smother mother. But Krishna can accept that. Krishna can accept this incredible love, or the love that the gopis have for Krishna. I mean, none of us could accept that kind of love. So no one in this world is a shelter like that. So how is the husband, the guru, the teacher, the parents, the temple authorities, how are they shelters? They're shelter in that they're giving you to your best friend. Prabhupada says any guru who says, I'm your best friend, he's bogus. Now, but still, they're your best friend because they're introducing you to the best friend. So when someone introduces you to Krishna, that person who introduces you, they're also your best friend. They're also a kind of shelter. They're a kind of shelter. And of course, in a practical, material sense, in a very limited way, obviously we have shelters. I was talking with Bibi Govinda Maharaj about whether or not ISKCON is a shelter. He said, well, ISKCON is sheltered me. It's giving me food and clothing and a place to stay. So ISKCON's my shelter. He said, but you know, Krishna is my only shelter. So it's like that. And not that you say to your husband, you're not sheltered, it's not Krishna. Then married life would be totally disrupted. I mean, it's like, it's the same way. If a husband says to the wife, you know, you're just a bunch of blood and pus and mucus. Prescriptions were miserable. Yeah, we could give a great ISKCON seminar. How to have a miserable family life all based on the Shastra. How to use Shastra to destroy all your material relationships. So, no, but that's a service. It's a service. It's your service to Krishna as a husband to take care of this jiva. That's your service. And part of your service is you better tell her she's beautiful. I don't care how old, fat, and ugly she is. No, that's your service. Because otherwise she's going to feel insecure. She'll think, oh, my husband thinks I'm ugly. He must be looking at other women who are more beautiful. She'll feel nervous. So that's your service. And it's a service for the woman to say, oh, you're such a hero. Without you, I couldn't do anything. That's her service. And also for social stability. Because Prabhupada says many women, women need men. There has to be some social stability. And if I'm honest, I admit, okay, I'm 20 years old, I'm 25 years old, or even I'm 40 years old, whatever it is. You know, and I need to have the association of the opposite sex. I can't function without it. Okay, fine. Let me do it in a righteous manner. And if I'm not thinking my husband is my shelter, then I'll be looking at others. So, practical. Practical. And how do I give shelter? By bringing people to Krishna. If I think I'm the shelter, then I'm a fool. What shelter can any of us give anybody? We can't even shelter ourselves. I can't even make sure that I make the right decisions. How in the world am I going to promise someone else that I'm always going to make the right decisions? Just trust me. How can you soundly say that? Nobody can say that. But I can say, you can trust that I'm going to do my best to try to help you come to Krishna. Right? You can say that. Is that okay? If you do that, if you see all your relationships, I'm doing this relationship to make Krishna happy. I'm teaching my students to make Krishna happy. I'm taking care of my child to make Krishna happy. I'm serving my husband to make Krishna happy. I'm taking care of my wife to make Krishna happy. Everything. Serving my guru to please Krishna. Then it's perfect. And then even if the other person disappoints you, he won't disappoint you because that wasn't where you were getting your shelter. If you're thinking, I'm working to please my wife, you know what? Your wife's not always going to be pleased with you. She's not even going to always be pleased with you for the things she said she would be pleased with you for doing. Do you know that?
creation work. He's just sitting around watching TV. Never does anything for Prabhupada. I wish he would do some preaching work. And then the husband gets into some preaching work. And he really gets into some preaching work. Heart and soul. Which is what she was praying to Krishna for the last 5 years. And then she's calling up and saying, my husband doesn't spend enough time with me anymore. Then why not? He's so involved in this preaching project. I said, well, that's what you said you wanted. You know, and then when the whole thing was over, the man said to me, why should I even bother? I did what my wife said, and all she did was complain, and why should I get involved in a preaching project again? Better to just watch television. And I said, well, but were you doing it to please your wife? And this is the problem. So we're thinking, I'm going to please my wife. The thing that you do something on Monday and it makes her happy on Wednesday, the same thing might not make her happy. And the same the other way. If you're thinking I'm going to make lasagna to please my husband, he always likes lasagna. And one day he comes home and says, why are you always making lasagna? You know, he doesn't even notice. You did a whole maha cleanup of the house. You spent 5 hours doing it. And he just comes and goes, why isn't dinner ready? You know, so if you're trying to, if you're thinking that my happiness in life is coming from pleasing another jiva, it's just not going to work. It's really not going to work. It's going to be very unhappy. And sometimes we think that, well, because the other jiva is a devotee, then it should be, you know, they should definitely be Krishna. We have higher expectations for our devotee relationships. So you're thinking, I'm doing this to please Krishna. Whether or not this other jiva is pleased with, that's not the source of my shelter. That's not how I'm getting my needs met. I'm getting my needs met by being connected with Krishna. So that's, if you can do that, you'll be happy in all circumstances. You'll be happy with everybody. You'll be happy in all relationships, all the time. And if ever you find yourself being disappointed, you'll know the cause immediately, and you won't blame the other person. As soon as you're unhappy with relationships, go, okay, how was I trying to make this person Krishna? Or how was I trying to be Krishna for this person? Like this group of people. And then you go, oh, that's the problem. And then you don't develop this bitterness and victim thing and all this sort of stuff. And you really don't need to be happy anyway. That's the key to happy relationship. Yes,
ma'am. I was wondering, even though philosophically we understand Krishna is the only shelter, how can we really take the shelter? When in some ways we experience shelter in other places, but we actually haven't directly experienced Krishna's shelter.
Oh, that's a lovely question. All this, so you're saying, theoretically we're convinced that Krishna's a shelter, but we experience some shelter from other objects and we're not fully experiencing shelter from Krishna. So first of all, I'd say I'm not sure that we're philosophically convinced. Because if I'm really convinced of something, I do it. So therefore, the progression of bhakti is a progression of faith. If I'm not fully taking shelter of Krishna, if I think, well, I'm saying on the one hand, okay, I fully believe that Krishna is my only shelter, but Krishna sometimes isn't really a good shelter, and some places really are a good shelter. So do I really believe that Krishna is the only shelter? Obviously not. Because then I have these contradictory ideas. So whatever appears to be a shelter, that shelter is really coming from Krishna. This is explained very nicely. I can't remember if it was the gopis or the wives of the brahmanas, who said that all of our family members are dear to us because you're there. You know, the reason that we feel, oh, my husband is my shelter, my child is my shelter, my house is my shelter. They're nothing but Krishna. This is explained. Oh, this is, I think it's the ninth chapter. Where Krishna says, I'm the mother, the father, the grandson. Is that ninth chapter? Nine. And there in the purport, prophet says, our mothers, our fathers, they're nothing but Krishna. Actually, Krishna. Whatever shelter we're appearing to get, we're actually getting that from Krishna. It's just like when I was very new in ISKCON, and I had just read Adivila chapter 7, which was published separately from the Chaitanya Charitamrita hadn't been published yet. And it was Prabhupada purporting Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's refutation of impersonalism. And I just read it, and I said, that's the one I read, I would really take notes. And this one Indian gentleman came to the Sunday feast and was arguing, and he was making all the points for impersonalism. And so I knew all the counterpoints because I had just studied them. I mean, he just gave all the arguments. It was like right out of the textbook, you know. And I gave all the counterarguments. He looked at me and said, I never met anybody as intelligent as you. So it was very easy in that circumstance for me to know that it was not my intelligence. I was just repeating. And in the same way, anybody, whatever anybody have, Krishna says that he's the ability in man, he's the intelligence in man, he's the strength of the strong, he's the austerity of the renouncers. Whatever splendor there is, he's that splendor. So it's really Krishna. So we have to see how really this is Krishna. Krishna's acting through somebody. And sometimes you can see it very clearly. I might have told this story before. And once I was looking in my closet, and I tell the story, I'm so sorry. So I was looking in my closet and I said, this is before I put that in suitcase. I said, well, I only have 4 silk saris. It'd be nice to have 1 more. I'd like it to be thick and beige with an embroidered border. And how long did that thought take? 10 seconds? And I thought, I can get one when I go to India, but that'd be like $40. I don't want to spend $40 on a sari. I already have 4. That's enough. Silly, I don't need another sari. That was the end of the whole thing. So 30 seconds total thought. And 3 days later, one of the parents picking up her kids at our school said, hey, let me have some for you. She hands me, as if I had custom ordered it. I mean, it was beige silk with an thick, with an embroidered border. I'm looking at this siren. My God. Now, of course, I said thank you to the lady. I didn't just say, well, it's really Krishna, no, excuse me. But I could understand it was Krishna. I mean, it wasn't very hard to understand it was Krishna. So sometimes it becomes right in front of our face that really everything I'm getting, all the shelter I'm getting is Krishna. And sometimes it's not so clear. As far as do we get shelter elsewhere? Well, yeah. In a limited, temporary, not fully satisfying way. Not the way that we really want. I mean, just try taking any material object situation, any other person, an animal, nature, whatever, and try making it your everything. And looking for unlimited, eternal, ever-expanding shelter and the fulfillment of all of your needs, and the thing will collapse immediately. You just can't do it. And try a little experiment of taking more shelter of Krishna. Do you know what it means to take shelter of Krishna? Should we get a definition? Would that help? Okay. Krishna is my protector and Krishna is my maintainer. Krishna is taking care of all of my needs all the time. And all I have to do is take care of his business. And he's taking care of my needs. I don't have to be in any anxiety about any of my needs ever. That was part of my service. I have to give the body a bath and, you know, I may have to buy some shoes. But I'm not thinking I'm the doer, nor do I think anyone else is the doer. Krishna is my protector, Krishna is my maintainer. He's taking care of me. Just like when you were a child, you fell asleep in the back of the car when your parents were driving somewhere. And they might have carried you into the next place sleeping. You may not even know where you're going. You didn't ask your parents, do you have a map? I can tell you a map. Do you know where you're going? Is there an petrol in the car? Are you driving safely? You just fell asleep in the back of the car. Or the traditional wife who takes care of the home, who serves the husband and trusts that the husband's going to maintain her and take care of her. That kind of trust. Krishna's going to take care of her. You could say, well, he might not take care of me in a way that I'd like. That's okay. Radha Krishna, Radha Krishna, Radha Krishna, Radha Krishna. If Krishna wants to give me a body that's sick and crippled and leave me on the street and leave me homeless and everybody hates me, then that must be the best way to take care of me, and I trust him. Just like the good child, you don't see this often, the good child trusts that the medicine the parent gives is going to help them. We have this kind of trust in doctors, by the way. If you really want to see some example in modern society of this level of trust, then you go to medicine. You know, just like Anupama was telling me, they told her, oh, your baby's sick, she has to get antibiotics. And she's, I'm afraid, baby's only 2 days old after antibiotics. after the hearing, the antibiotics, they say, now you better go to a specialist to have her hearing checked. She says, why? This? She says, these antibiotics, can they damage the hearing? Oh, yeah. But they don't say that beforehand. You know, so you think about modern medicine, where people go for their, not all the bodhisattvas, but in general society, people go for their checkups, and the doctor says, I found cancer, and you didn't have any symptoms. And don't you know people who tell us? Now, they have bad reports that a lot of these early screening tests are not even accurate. That a lot of the times when they say you have cancer, you don't. But, you know, you're not going to be willing to say, well, probably your tests are inaccurate. So you go there and they say you have cancer. And if you don't get any treatment, you're going to die in 6 months. And you don't know anything. They just show you this bunch of lines and you can't read it. You don't know what it means. And they say, there's your tumor. And you go, okay. Yeah. If they didn't tell you what it meant, you wouldn't know. And then they tell you, okay, well, now we're going to cut you open. I mean, do we normally allow people to cut us open? You know, if Krishna says, okay, you know, you got envy in your heart, we're going to have to cut. No, it's okay, forget it. But when the doctors say, we have to cut, you go, okay. You know, and if you don't have insurance, you got to pay all your money. Pay all your money. People second, third mortgage their house, go bankrupt, borrow money from all of their relatives, sell all their possessions so they can get the treatment. And then the doctor says, okay, now that we've cut you open, now we're going to flood your body with poison. And it's going to destroy your immune system, all your hair's going to fall out. Every time you touch something, it's going to be painful. And you wonder why you had to get java beads made of fabric because it hurts so much for a touch of beads in chemotherapy. It's going to destroy your emotions. She was telling me she became like a 12-year-old girl again. But we say, okay, sure, I'll take the poison. Right? And then we're going to radiate you. I was reading about how they have these super precise radiation that just hit the tumor if they aim it right. And sometimes they don't aim it right. Sometimes it destroys something else. And they've got to put the shields up because it's super high-powered radiation. It was a long article in the New York Times about this. They have to put the shields up. And it said, if you're going to use this technology, you're not allowed to look at the patient for a minute. You have to keep your eyes on the computer constantly. The people are used to watching the patient, not the computer. So they don't notice the shield hasn't been put up. They don't notice the pain's in the wrong place. And it destroys, you know, I mean, and it's not like instant death. It's long, painful, miserable, probably worse than cancer even. But they say, okay, we're going to do the latest, greatest radiation. And you don't say, I wonder if people have been trained to. You just go, okay. And you trust. It's our most valuable possession, our body. You know, we trust on the basis of people who have some authority. But we're not willing to have one-hundredth that amount of trust in Krishna. It might hurt. Krishna, if you take away my lust of pride and envy, it might hurt. And he says, yeah, probably will. Will, yeah. You know, but when the doctor tells you it might hurt, you're afraid. So that's what it means to take shelter of Krishna, means you trust. And you say, okay, Lord, however you want to do this, it's okay with me. Whatever's involved with you know, it's going to be worth it to get unlimited eternal ecstasy. And I'm going to trust you. I'm going to trust you. You're going to take care of everything for me. You're going to take care of everything material. You're going to take care of everything spiritual. And I'll just, you know, going to go with it. And my business is just how may I serve you, 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 how may I serve you. That's my business. Your business is taking care of me. And if you do that a little bit, if you can do that this much, your life becomes this much better. And if you can do that this much, your life becomes this much better. And if you can do it completely, your life becomes an unlimited festival. Do remember that taking shelter of Krishna doesn't mean that you see anybody else's. The institution, I'm sorry, is not Krishna. The guru is not Krishna. That's my body philosophy. Your husband is not Krishna. Your temple president is not Krishna. Your best friends are not Krishna. The building is not Krishna. Don't try to take shelter of something that's not Krishna as if it's Krishna. You'll be very disappointed. And then you'll blame the thing. Oh, why wasn't it Krishna? It's okay. That's how you take shelter of Krishna. Very simple. I should stop now. Thank you very much.